Welcome to this podcast produced by the International Monetary Fund. In this program, how to attract more private investment in Africa.
First, you need to address the risk, the project risk, the currency risk, this facility to exit. But sometimes it's not enough. Sometimes just fixing the business environment is not enough.
With public finances stretched to the limit and the pandemic making things worse by the day, new IMF research looks at innovative ways to get the private sector more involved in financing Africa's development needs.
Incentives can be quite controversial.
Right.
But I think at the same time, the truth is that many projects in development sectors in Africa won't happen without the government support. My name is Luc Hérault. I'm mission chief for the West African Currency Union. And I work with a team of IMF economists on this project on private finance for development. The paper was published last month at the time of the Paris summit on financing African economies. It was a summit that gathered African head of states, donors, and international organizations. And the main topic of the discussion was the COVID crisis, of course, and its terrible social consequences.
So much of the development we've seen in Africa in recent years has been largely driven by public investment. But you know, now with the pandemic having put so much pressure on public finances, to what extent will governments need to rely on private investment for development strategies from here on in?
Well, that's a very good question. I mean, I think this what you mentioned here is not new. There have always been tensions between, I would say, the very large development needs in Africa and the very scarce public resources to cover them. There have been very significant progress, I think, in past decades, mm-hmm. but development gaps remain very large. Education enrollment rates are low, infant mortality is high, there's a lack of basic infrastructure outside the big cities, power outages, etc. So the development needs are very large, but the resources provided by the public sector and the donors are limited. As you know, on the public sector side, governments are small, countries are poor, and so their tax bases are limited.
Yeah.
So Africa relies a lot on donor financing, but donor money itself is also not unlimited. So there is a tension, I would say, between the size of these development needs and the public resources. And the COVID pandemic has made the situation actually even worse. The crisis, as you know, has led to a contraction in domestic revenues and access to global financial markets has become more difficult for these countries. At a time where the expenditure on health and income support has increased. So I think the scale of these needs that has been aggravated by the COVID pandemic will require efforts from all stakeholders, including private investors.
So how much private investment has there been in Africa in recent years?
Well, I think there is not much private investment going to development sectors in Africa. There is, of course, a lot of private investment, but private investment going specifically to infrastructure, to education, to health, there is little. 95% of the projects in infrastructure in Africa are carried out by the public sector, like line ministries or state-owned enterprises. In fact, the volume of infrastructure projects with participation of the private sector has declined quite significantly in the past decade following the commodity price bust. And you can also see that at the international level when you look at foreign direct investment. Only 2% of global flows of foreign direct investment go to Africa. And when investment goes to Africa, it's predominantly to natural resources, extractive industries, not to health, road or water.
So obviously, private investment is going to be super important. But, you know, with interest rates such as they are, especially in the United States, there's no lack for investors looking for higher yield. Why does Africa struggle so much to attract these private investors?
Well, that's indeed quite puzzling at first glance, because Africa holds immense opportunity for investors. It has young, growing population, abundant resources. The cities are seeing massive growth. There are important, digitalization processes underway. So a large part of our research has been to try to understand why international investors are not coming more. We talked to many investors in London, in New York, in Africa, and what the discussion shows that three main risks really dominate investors' mind. The first risk is what we call the project risk. Africa presents a lot of opportunities, but many of them are not sufficiently developed. They are not what investors call investor-ready, bankable. Projects are in the books of ministries of economy or planning, but they are not really, they have not really gone through all the feasibility studies and preparatory analysis that would make the project sufficiently advanced to be appealing to an investors. And the problem is that investors, they don't know well Africa, and they don't want to invest in very early stage or unfamiliar concepts.
So potential investors in public infrastructure projects in Africa, you're saying, hesitate because of the risks?
Yes, absolutely. They hesitate and they see risk as being elevated. I mean, some of the risks that they are mostly concerned about relate a lot to exit, interestingly. So, if you want to come to a country, you need to be sure that you can exit the country and make money out of it.
Right.
So a lot of the problems relate to exit risk and the ability of investors to leave the country, recoup their gains and go back home. And there are important risks in Africa. First one is currency risk. If you make a returns of 10% a year, but your currency depreciates by 5% a year, this eliminates half of your profits. And so when investors leave the country, they need to convert their gains into their own currency. And so the currency risk is very important. But there are also other constraints on exiting. I mean, sometimes capital controls, sometimes a legal framework that create legal battles for investors to have their property rights recognized, sometimes also narrow and underdeveloped financial markets, which prevent them from issuing shares in order to exit so that they can sell the shares of the project to other investors. So yes, there are definitely risks and concerns on the investor side.
So just to put this into context for people who might not completely understand how investors make money in public investment, could you give us a bit of a primer on how it works for investors? Say, they invest in a public road or a bridge, for example. How do they get a return on that investment, and what might the return be on average?
But there are many ways of investing, actually. One, the simplest way to invest is to do direct investment. So meaning you are an investor in Germany, for instance, and you select a company in Africa that you think is a good company and you buy a share of this company or you lend to this specific company. But this is not always possible. For instance, you can maybe buy a share of an infrastructure company in road, but it may be more difficult to do that for a school or a hospital. A lot of companies actually working in development are non-listed. They are not listed on stock markets. And you also need very specialized expertise or competence in order to select a specific company. So that's why most investors, they rely on, a two-tier structure where they don't invest directly in a project, but they invest in a specialized fund. And the fund itself knows well Africa and know the context, the environment, and is going to invest in infrastructure project. And that's, you've probably already heard about this fund that are called private equity funds or debt funds or infrastructure funds. These are the type of channels of investment for international investors.
So there's another type of investor that your research identifies as having great potential, and that is the global institutional investor, like pension funds and insurance companies and the like, and even philanthropists to a certain degree. What do you think is, why is it such a good idea to bring them in, and what's holding them back?
Well, I think it's a good idea because they are really large. Africa needs more private finance. So there is a big potential here, mostly unrealized. On the institutional investor side, it's true that there have been a lot of debate on involving this type of investors. Here we are talking about big pension funds, big insurance companies at the global level. These institutional investors have a lot of money. They manage $100 trillion of assets.
Wow.
And almost nothing of this money goes to Africa. Actually, only 0.5% of the total foreign investments of global pension funds goes to Africa.
Why is that?
I think there is interest on their side. As you mentioned, the low interest rate environment, I mean, infrastructure in Africa can offer higher returns. And for them also, one thing that they could appreciate is the fact that this infrastructure investment yield cash flows over a very long period of time. And, you know, institutional investors, they have liabilities. They owe money to people over also a very long period of time. So like if you're a pension fund, your pension liabilities are quite long. So for them, this matching between the length of the assets and the length of the liabilities could be a big benefit. So then why are they not coming more to Africa? First, because they are risk adverse. They do not want to invest in very new project at the original construction phase. They prefer what we call brownfield projects, projects that are already well developed, advanced, and less risky. Another issue also is that I think institutional investors have very little expertise on Africa and capacity to assess projects. So that's why they need to rely on funds and to invest in Africa. And these funds are not really developed as well. And finally, there are a lot of prudential regulation that in some cases constrain the ability of institutional investors to invest in Africa. So I think that's why they are not coming more.
And the report also examines the efficacy of incentives offered by governments to potential investors. And we hear a lot about tax breaks, for example, to corporations, where the benefits to those countries are not always that obvious. What types of incentives do you see as being effective and, well, mutually beneficial? And how common are those incentives in Africa?
Yes. In a sense, I think the way I would see this question is to say that first you need to improve the business environment. You need to address the risks that we discussed, the project risk, the currency risk, this facility to exit. Yeah. But sometimes it's not enough, and that's a problem. Sometimes just fixing the business environment is not enough. And we have plenty of examples of African countries that have made a lot of effort on improving their business environment, but still private investors do not come, even in the most favorable business environment. And that's when, in this condition, you need this extra push to make infrastructure projects attractive to private investors. So what do we mean by government incentives? I mean, there are many forms, but basically there are variations of subsidies and guarantees. Subsidies are here to improve the returns of investors, and guarantees are here to reduce the risks for investors. But as you mentioned, I think these incentives can be quite controversial, not least because they are very costly and risky for governments. And you have probably heard of this experience with public-private partnerships that were poorly designed. And in these contracts, sometimes these contracts can lead to renegotiations or activation of special clauses that are very costly and bad for government or for public finances.
Right.
But I think at the same time, the truth is that many projects in development sectors in Africa won't happen without the government support. So, for instance, in East Asia, 90% of infrastructure projects with the private sector participation receive government support.
Wow.
So these incentives are important, but they need to be well designed to make sure that they are efficient, but they are not too costly or too risky. So a lot, big part of our work at the IMF is to assist countries in the design of these incentives to make them very efficient. Mm. So what does it mean in practice, actually? It means that incentives should be targeted. They should not be given to everybody. They should be temporary, because if you start subsidizing a sector or a project forever, it's probably that this project is not a good project. They should be granted on the basis of proven market dysfunction, should be transparent. And most importantly, they should show something that is called additivity, meaning that incentives should make worthy projects happen that would not have happened otherwise. So you are not here to subsidize projects that would have happened otherwise.
And you look at an interesting aspect of this in terms of, you know, what it might cost for governments to provide those incentives and whether or not governments can actually afford to do that, and where aid money sometimes is used to help governments provide those incentives that that they need to attract these investors. Talk to us a little bit about blending. How does this work?
Yes, absolutely. Incentives are costly. So governments has to face the reality that if they want to attract private investors, there will be a cost attached to it. And the idea that you could shift this cost from the public to the private sector is not going to work so easily, actually. So one possibility that is currently discussed and quite promising is to shift some of this cost from governments to donors. And the idea would be that donors would provide, could provide some of these incentives to the private sector. So that's what is called the blending model. And many advanced economies have developed blending mechanisms to provide support to the private sector. It's also the case of international organizations like the World Bank, and that has developed something called the private sector window.
And that's essentially a sea change in the way that aid money is going towards development in these countries.
Yes, absolutely. It's a change, actually, because traditionally aid money goes to public investment and finances budget. So, and the idea, of course, is not to say that all aid money should be reallocated from public investment towards incentives for private investment. It depends on the income level of the country, on its governance structure, on its, you know, the quality of its institutions. So, but in some cases, some reallocation of aid money from traditional use towards blending could be considered and beneficial.
Luc Hérault, economist and advisor in the IMF African Department and co-author of Private Finance for Development, the subject of our talk today. Thanks, Luc.
Thank you very much.
Private Finance for Development study is published on the IMF website. That's imf.org. There's also a blog based on the research. Check it out at blogs.imf.org. And look for other IMF podcasts wherever you get your podcasts. You can also follow us on Twitter at IMF_podcast. I'm Bruce Edwards. Thanks for listening.